Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show, Saturday, October 11th, 2008. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and we are gathered today on the topic, the unique nature of human and scientific creativity. And we are very glad to have with us off-site, speaking to us from the basement, many of you have heard about. You can call it maybe Creativity Central. But we welcome today in the discussion from the LaRouche Political Action Committee Youth Movement, Sky Shields. Hi, Sky.
Hi, Marcia.
And Chris Landry. Welcome.
How do you do?
And this question of creativity, human creativity, the topic that we've chosen arises out of the whole situation we're now in, which you could call a new phase in human history without exaggerating. It's to be seen in the recent several days, 10 days of crash of what remains of the kind of financial structure since September 30th, which is the end of the financial year for a large part of the world as well as the United States. And what's happened is the financial system, a kind of casino-based system, all over the past year was already broken. It was busted. But now, in recent days, hour by hour, all the pretenses are gone. All of the kind of Potemkin village pretenses of the markets and so forth and so on have just blown out. Now, as all of you know, Lyndon LaRouche called this way in advance. Years ago, he warned of it, this dissociation of the real physical economy from this crazy, this ballooning of speculation. Last year, last summer in 2007, he announced the collapse was on, even if no one believed it or saw it. And he has initiated what to do and opened a storm of organizing in the United States and around the world. And in recent days, actually at in Washington, D.C., and in statements, he said, watch out, the first 10 to 15 days when accounts are due and reckoning has to come since September 30th, the end of the financial year, this is gone. So what he has been emphasizing in recent days, discussion with Sky Shields, with Chris, with many other people, is that we have the critical task in this epic collapse is to restore attention to and the role of scientific creativity. That because humanity can't, this is my words, not his, humanity can't muddle through, we're not going to stumble along, even if all the evil ones try and run everything and take over, evil cunning can't run anything either. So what in particular, what's in discussing this, LaRouche has written a new paper I'd like to alert everyone to and look at the relevant websites over the next 24 hours. The LaRouche Political Action Committee, that's LaRouchePAC.com, and then our own LaRouchePub.com. Look for this paper, Why the Economists Failed, Economy and Creativity. This is by Lyndon LaRouche. And along with this is going to be posted and published a write-up, a new paper by Sky Shields. And Sky, I think your title, I just saw it a few hours ago, Human Creative Reason as a Fundamental Principle in Physics, right?
Yes.
So this, in other words, people can, they can just turn on their TV if they can stand it and hear about everything, including the wild nuclear bomb of the financial world, derivatives detonating around the world. You can hear all this, but now we're going to turn our attention to this question of creativity. Now, and Sky, I hope during the hour you'll be raising, I know you will, I think, particulars about your investigations, ongoing and very interesting things you found. But can you begin by, I think, what you ended your paper on about the task that we have to restore the concept, the idea of the concept of human mind or cognition as the organizing principle in reality, not some construct, some empiricist thing. Is that right?
Yes, and it's, given the political moment that we're at right now, it's become a very real question for us as an association, as a political movement, and naturally for the American population and the world as a whole. That the word creativity is tossed around a lot, and people know this. You know, everything in the world, as a, you know, from splattering paint on the wall to, you know, traipsing naked through the woods, all these things get classed underneath creativity. You know, any new scientific theory, whether or not there's a reason for it. If you can publish a new book on it and it's new, then that's called creativity. But Lynn, Mr. LaRouche, has meant something very specific by it, and which is why he's been happy about the work that we've been doing recently in the basement, which is the ability to take a self-critical look at yourself as though from the outside, and then from that standpoint, generate qualities in yourself that didn't exist prior, figure out what's been wrong with my thought process up to this moment, how do I act on it to change it, what sort of fundamental shifts are necessary to move myself to a higher state of really existence than I was at prior. And we're at that point right now socially. You're watching this complete meltdown of all the idiocy that's been implemented economically, politically, over the course of the last decades. The financial establishment that is supposed to be running this, that created the crisis, they're at a complete loss of what to do. They're moving to all sorts of different types of panic measures, throwing money at the thing, which is going to create a bigger hyperinflationary crisis. The Congress is paralyzed. At this point, it's sort of this is the moment where the human species needs to take a step back now, humanity as a whole, and say, what have we done wrong over these last 40 years? And take a look at what LaRouche has been saying consistently over these, has been a consistent, incorrect, ideological, axiomatic outlook that's governed the thought processes of the population as a whole over the last really four or more decades. And that's creativity. That's creativity in the sense that we're investigating.
Well, let me ask you further on that, or Chris as well. And one thing we've seen in the recent couple weeks is the kind of revolt mood among the American population. In other words, there was a kind of deep cultural reflex reaction, positive and negative, I'll say, but deep reflex reaction that we don't want to bail out sharks. These rich bums shouldn't get a free ride. You know, that kind of anger. So this isn't a solution, but you're saying it's an opportunity?
It's the emotional response, as far as it goes in the population, is correct. They're realizing that they've been screwed, they've been swindled. But now the reflection, this is where creativity enters into this, is that the population needs to recognize the degree to which they were complicit in this swindle. And what we saw built up over these last few decades was an ideological outlook in the world population that the population was sold on. The idea that LaRouche has called what really is liberalism, the idea that truth does not matter. There's no such thing as objective truth, and, you know, if there is, it doesn't have enough status for us to pay any real attention to it. What's got status is who's got the power, who's got the money, what is popular opinion saying? And people have been governed by that. They've been sucked into that. And so you've seen a collapse in questions of scientific method, questions of philosophical rigor. The very idea that you had a whole population that would accept even the existence of the stock market, the money markets in their present form as they exist right now, and to accept that as economics, that was a form of corruption that existed in the population. You know, there's a more explicit corruption that you saw with the people who were directly taking part in the thing, and they're rightfully taking the brunt of this thing as it collapses. But now what's necessary is for the population to take that rage and direct it into some reflection and say, what direction is the human species supposed to be moving in? If everything we did over these last decades was wrong, what's correct?
Right. Okay, say something real quick.
Please, Chris, yeah.
Well, I was going to say, because what Sky's bringing up, as LaRouche has pointed out, we're living in a long cycle of history where immediate things are occurring as a result of decisions which were made years ago, you know, before Sky and I were born, right? and a lot of what LaRouche has been bringing up is directly addressing this question of changing history, and that requires that we fight what is known as tradition. And tradition is sort of like, you know, the way things have always been done, and, you know, you kind of go along with what's already been given to you, where you're not actually, you know, to use the old, like, cliche metaphor, you're not actually getting off the Titanic, right, but you're just merely moving things around on it, right? You have a sort of tradition, a familiar tradition with, you know, certain political policies and financial policies, like, for instance, the bailout, you know, the politicians and the financiers and even the people are so brainwashed by this idea that money is value, that they've gone so far as to say, well, the way to fix the problem is to actually throw more money at it, right? And, you know, John Hopeful, if he were here, you know, he had compared this to, you know, spraying cold gasoline on a hot fire, right?
Right.
It's exactly what you don't want to do, but since there is no solution which people are willing to adopt that is outside of what their system is, that therefore you have a failed society. And this comes out of tradition, which then forms this idea of tragedy, where it's not, you know, what people think tragedy is. You know, it's not just like a tragic individual, but it's the fact that in entire culture, no one stands up to go against the popular opinion and say, hey, this is insane, this is nuts. We got to think outside of what we've been given. And really, that's also, I mean, to sum it up, that's really the issue of where creativity comes in, because the human mind has to be able to conceptualize something which other people are not thinking of or has never been thought of before, or maybe something that worked in the past and can be introduced today. So you can think of creativity as being like the opposite of tradition, where tradition is just memorization, the old ways, the way we do things. And creativity saying, well, if we keep doing this, we're going to kill ourselves. We better think of something different. That's uniquely human.
I think, Chris, and I refer people again to LaRouche's new paper, Why the Economists Failed, Economy and Creativity. I think he said that progress doesn't result from the same old habits, but revolutions in habits. In other words, introducing these new practices. And even though, I guess, entire millions of a population may not see it that way, there are certain moments and opportunities we have to change things. One thing is, let me just ask, in what you're drawing out about real creativity, not novelty or not what Sky said at the beginning, one thing is that there are those who, we see them in the U.S. population, who definitely are mad and stepping back to look at how awful it was to have day traders, to have a kind of Las Vegas sense about the whole economy, you know, all the market speculation, what can you get? And they have some inclination towards having good physical things, let's call it, you know, some bridges, some highways, do some real work. But there's also you run into problems there when you think, let me put it this way, Nancy Pelosi, I think, has announced today that on Monday there's going to be hearings in Washington where she's going to meet with so-called economists, all right, Lawrence Summers and others, because they want to make a fight over her stimulus infrastructure package. I don't want to speak pornographically here.
Excuse me. No, they already have.
I said it, I guess. And I haven't had a chance. I don't know what's in it, but I can imagine it includes these crazy swindle deals for so-called public-private partnerships. That's a parlor room name for giveaways to build a little something here or to have a rip-off over there of a highway, like in Texas, this big trans-Texas corridor. It's crazy. So on the one hand, that can affect people and says, you know, what do you want to say about that? You can't. It begs the issue of what's an economy, right? Not just a few good things somewhere.
Mm-hmm. That really is. See, the issue is you've got the debate focused on all these specifics. It really is sort of like, you know, it becomes which direction do you toss the gasoline? You get all these things none of these things that are being debated anywhere. None of the so-called sides of, you know, do we pour a bunch of money on this thing, do we not? Neither one of those are the solution, because neither one of those is addressing the problem, which is that people have had a backwards ideology about a backwards idea of what economics is. What is a human economic system? Right? Is the nature of the human species to try and just find some kind of comfortable niche? Is the definition of profit making money, or is the definition of profit having resources? none of those are what makes the human species characteristically human. What makes us characteristically human is the ability to reflect back on everything about our existence, our method of social organization, economic organization, examine this thing as though from the outside for paradox, and then push for fundamental upshifts in the way we operate, fundamental new discoveries in the physical sciences, right? New principles that challenge everything that we believed prior, new economic principles that challenged everything that came prior. This was a principle that existed in the founding of the United States as the first real time in human history that you had a stable organization outside of the feudal structures that had existed in Europe. This was an upgrade in the way human society organized itself. And you had that as a steady tradition in the backwards of the U.S. that began to be rolled backwards. You had a grouping that was in opposition to this quality from the beginning, from the inception of the United States. But really, over the course of the last 40 years, this thing has been rolled back completely. The idea that we've reached the end of science, there's no new fundamental principles to be discovered in science because empiricism explains everything. All physical phenomena can be reduced to the actions of particles in the small. There's no such thing, there's no need to investigate any of these sort of macroscopic organizations because there's no independent principle of life. There's no independent principle of human cognition. These are just sort of epiphenomena.
Or you have the fact that you have the axiom that the universe is entropic.
Yeah, entropy is as accepted as a principle, really as a form of religious belief, has said that, okay, well, there's no room for further progress. And that same ideology has spread itself into the arts, into culture, that this is the end of the development of human society. There's no room for fundamental principles to be discovered. Now it's just sort of we've reached a place where we have a zero-sum game, where we're just going to be perpetually engaged in activities of self-entertainment. That now the question isn't that now the population, now that we've reached the end of history, the question is just figuring out how to subsist in this form. And people bought into that. The American population bought into that.
Yeah.
And now they're realizing that it's not a sustainable outlook. But the question needs to be posed, what is? Now, which direction do we go from here?
Right. Well, does that bring us, unless you want to say something here, we can come back to it too, but to some of your particular investigations about the flag bearers, those who certain people over the last 200 years that you're looking into more closely, who've been fighting and philosophically thinking about the question of the what's fundamental about human creativity. I'm speaking about the work that you just wrote up that's ongoing. If you could mention some of that. One thing that pops out is you were looking at Wolfgang Kohler and the question of Gestalt psychology. I mean, that is conceptualization from a different point of view than little mini, you know what I mean, aggregations of mini events or mini.
It's important because one is the phrase and the subject area of Gestalt psychology has become something that's just sort of wacky today. It's
turned
into.
Let's erase that. Go ahead.
We'll reclaim it for what Kohler's actual intent was. It was none of the sort of the kind of new age wackiness that it's become now.
That's right.
In fact, it was a revival of the scientific method of the people that we've been investigating here in the basement, in particular Johannes Kepler, which is to say that the human mind is a fundamental principle in the universe. The principle of human cognition is not an accident. It's not something that's built up from the actions of particles in the small. That the principles of human cognition and the principle of life are independent governing principles that, in fact, are the principles from which the principles of the abiotic organization are deduced. That the principles of physics are not the building blocks of life and cognition. They are derivatives of life and cognition as fundamental principles. And this is clear, and this is what the real essence of the Gestalt philosophy was that the human mind deals with wholes, units that aren't composed of parts. Unitary ideas, the act of you know, memorizing a musical composition or a piece of poetry for presentation and performance is not you accruing all the individual parts. It's not a series of words or notes that you've got stored in your mind, but it's a single idea that you want to communicate. And the existence, the quality, the specific quality of that single idea is what orders the parts that then communicate it. In the mind of the composer, you have a single musical idea that governs the way the notes are laid down. It's not the laying down of the notes that creates the idea. Well, in the course of speech, it is the idea that governs how the sentence unfolds. It's not a sequence of words placed one after another that gives you, eventually builds up the idea. And what they recognize, the people, the work thinkers around Köhler and Köhler recognize, is a fact that goes all the way back to the work of Johannes Kepler, and is implicit is explicit in the work of Bernard Riemann in a special way. But it's the fact that this is not just a question of the way, this is the way the human mind operates, but the reason it's the way the human mind operates is because it's also how the universe works. That you've got that ideas exist first as principles, universal principles in the physical universe. They then order every process that it comes underneath them, so to speak. You've got the behavior of the so-called elementary particles is really something that arises from the intersection of larger principles. And the place where it became very clear was where in discussions that first that Köhler had with Max Planck on the topic of the quantum and all the paradoxes that were coming up around quantum theory, which really befuddled all the thinkers at the time and drove the quantum mechanists mad. And you ended up with this lunatic form of quantum mechanics now, which is nothing like what was intended by Planck originally. What Planck recognized in looking at Köhler's, and some of Köhler's work in psychology, and he said as much to Köhler himself, was that what the paradox we're running into is that you've left out the real human cognitive quality of intention by taking this path by taking the scientific path, course of investigation that was laid out by the controllers of Isaac Newton, which is to say that it's possible to investigate the quote-unquote objective physical universe as though man were not in it. And as soon as you exclude that, you start running into, you set up the fact that inevitably you're going to run into certain paradoxes that tell you that this quality of mind, intention, exists in the physical universe. Now that was recognized by Köhler, that was recognized by Planck, and it was attacked by their peers. You already had it. You were having a major revolt against the idea of the human mind in the United States in psychology, with the schools around the behaviorists, worse around these logical positivists, and nuts like Bertrand Russell. We were making a push to eliminate this, the human mind as a principle, and there were political reasons for that, which is largely to create the political circumstances that we see around it today. But the point of using Köhler's work as an example was because in the course of our work here in the basement, the current investigation that we're involved in is illustrating and animating the mind of Bernard Riemann, which is, as LaRouche likes to point out, makes the point, this is really where real science ended, even though you had some people who were in this, people who later on who were in this tradition, Planck, Köhler, Einstein, in fact, in his defense of science against the madness that was appearing with quantum mechanics at that time. But Bernard Riemann represents the last time that you really had this, I mean, aside from these sort of isolated expressions later, the last time that you had this real scientific approach that said that we're investigating these questions in physics, we're investigating these questions in the abiotic, and in particular, where the point of agreement between Curler and Riemann was on the question of potential. But we're investigating these, but what we're really seeing expressed is that there is mind exists as a governing principle in the physical universe. And so we're investigating in the abiotic, what we're looking for are these types of, these organized wholes, these circumstances where you can see that there's a clear intent, that there you see the phenomena of future states of processes governing the past states. That it's the question of the whole that governs the behavior of the isolated parts. And that this is the characteristic of the physical universe. It's not some accidental quality of it. And our big push was to pull this out of Riemann's own philosophical writings, his philosophical fragments.
Are they extensive? You've been looking at them. The philosophical fragments.
What's been published, this is something we've got to this part of our current project. There is, what has been published is what existed in the collection that was pulled together by Heinrich Weber. That was what was transcribed from notes that Riemann himself wrote. And that is very small, what's been published, and it's been small by design. I mean, what we're going through is basically reconstructing these things because in an effort to falsely classify these fragments into different subject matter. Oh, these are on epistemology. These are on physical science. To create this split between the way the human mind functions and the way the physical science operates. In an effort to generate that, these things were intentionally clipped. And we've been going through some of the original manuscripts, which has been a project. It's involved us. You know, we're still a ways from seeing if we can, you know, be able to decipher Riemann's handwriting. But the idea is to look back at these things and to reconstruct the way Riemann's thought process actually must have functioned, and to kind of to undo some of the cover-up that was done by the way, in the way Heinrich Weber organized the Riemann Verica. And our biggest, so the actual fragments that are unpublished fragments are quite extensive. There's thousands of folio, about 5,000 folio pages of Riemann's Nachlass, what his literary remains that we're ordering in chunks and sifting through. So that much is extensive. But it'll be a project to really organize that, present that. Our main guiding principle in organizing that is what the work we've done so far on what we know about the way the human creative process has to function based on what we know from Johannes Kepler. That's been our guiding principle now in being able to look at Riemann and to unravel, to get through a lot of the obfuscation that's been put in the way.
Oh, great. Let me ask you one other thing about all of this ongoing work you're talking about. What did, on Curler's work about how the mind conceptualizes, what kind of work did he do, or what are you looking at for your purposes?
This has been, it's a funny, what's been really the most interesting, I mean, because some of the material, some of the conclusions that he draws are conclusions that anybody who's very familiar with the actual history of science would be aware of. I mean, the existence of a gestalt in human thought and in physics, you know, again, this goes back to the beginning of science. This goes back to Kepler. It's explicitly stated in the work of Gottfried Leibniz. This is Leibniz's monad. And this was picked up already in the generation around Gauss and Riemann by a number of thinkers in psychology. One person who LaRouche has stressed we need to investigate is Herbart. I believe it's Johann Friedrich Herbart. I believe this is but he's a psychologist who explicitly taking off from Leibniz's concept of the monad. This thing as an efficient existence in the human mind and in physical reality, taking off from that, begins to elaborate a real psychology, human psychology. And this is different. This is not the kind of pathological studies you get from Freud and others. You know, it's not a did you want to sleep with your uncle's goat, and is that why you're dreaming about, you know, fishes or something?
Yeah, right.
But this is, this is an investigation of human creativity and how does it function. And so this was a trend that existed in psychology, which I'm sure made its way to ultimately up in, is an explanation for why you get the approach you get from Curler and others. But it certainly made its way immediately into the work of Bernard Riemann, his work on physics, as he says explicitly in these fragments, that conceptual approach of applying, recognizing that principles of mind are what govern phenomena in the abiotic in physics, that was something that was already clear in Riemann's day, and it was Riemann's methodological approach. It's how he approached this idea, this question of potential. So what's interesting in Curler's work, in his discussions with Planck and others, is that they've got a very rigorous study of the human mind and human creativity as such, as the human mind, not as something, not as reducible to other physical phenomena, but as a an independent, efficient existence in the physical universe. And their rigorous studies of this and the phenomena and the empirical observations they make in that area, they then carry over and realize this answers a number of problems that arose in physical phenomena only because of the neglect of Kepler's scientific outlook. So in him, we've got a number. The main thing you've got is you've got an expanded resource now to go back and relook at some of these questions, some of these dead ends that have appeared, things like quantum mechanics, and areas of biology that, you know, biology has reached a dead end because of the prominence of molecular biology. Physics, because of the rise of quantum mechanics and the excessive focus on reducing all phenomena to atomic phenomena, has reached a conceptual dead end. And a thorough study of the human mind and human creativity at this point, along the lines of Curler's published works, but also his unpublished studies, which we know from lectures and other discussions included an intensive investigation into questions of classical artistic composition, in particular classical musical composition, the German classics for him.
And these are unpublished, and that's another area of work then, you mean?
Exactly, yeah. They exist only really in the forms of his discussions, but all of his students are very clear this has played a major role in his philosophical development. And it exists in his speeches and other things. He never had a chance to compose a book on the subject, but the people who are familiar with him are aware that he had enough, he had a thorough enough knowledge on the subject to have composed a book on it. Uh-huh. They occur, questions of composition, musical composition, occur frequently as pedagogical examples in his psychological work. Because these are where you see the actual characteristic. These are the types of activities that are characteristic of the human mind. So if you want to investigate the human mind and human creativity and human psychology, this is what you study. With our current program that LaRouche has laid out for his political movement now, we've got the ability to take a real detailed study of human creativity in those areas and now apply it back to these dead ends that have appeared in the physical science and, you know, ultimately in questions of economics and policy more generally.
Let me, if you or Chris want to draw out a few things you mentioned about quantum mechanics, biology, the reductionist kind of reductionist atomic physics. One thing in biology, I think you might have used this example in your paper, but there is this assertion or ideology of a small particle, an atom or whatever, of some substance. I think you mentioned carbon, but it's always the same no matter what circumstance in which it is, the domain in which you find it. This is an example of the dead end kind of thinking that prevents breakthroughs. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Chris may have some more to say.
Actually, I think a good thing to do before that, because that is important in terms of the what we have today in terms of investigations, I think, where we need to go. But
okay.
I think one of the more important things that you can't dismiss is this exactly what Sky's bringing up, which I think this is the real revolutionary thing that's been occurring lately in the work that we've been doing, is this idea of the of a unified concept of the physical universe, the idea of the investigation of the mind, and the real subjective nature of science. And I can get it, what your question is, Marcia, about this these are smallest particles and whatnot that are, you know, questions about investigations into science today. If you look at what Sky is saying about how the people that are being investigated right now in the basement, like Riemann and Curler and these various other individuals, and what Leibniz and whatnot, right? What does this mean when they say that they're going back to the method of Kepler? Well, one specific fundamental foundation of science in the work of Kepler is this idea of the harmonics. And what Kepler does with the harmonics is he takes a completely unique look at the universe. It's not what we think of harmonics. A popular conception of harmonics is that, you know, harmony is somehow music.
Yeah, or resonance or something.
Exactly. It's some sort of like something that you hear. Well, one thing that the way that Kepler investigates this is not just from the domain of hearing, but also the domain of sight, which was something which was unheard of, I guess you can say, for lack of a better word, at the time, because everyone always thought of harmonics as being music. Kepler's idea of harmonics is not something that you hear. Kepler says that, you know, harmony is expressed in music because music is harmony applied by the mind of man, right? And investigation into abstract harmony, which is into geometry, physical constructive geometry, anti-Euclidean geometry, and these type of things, is actually, and what you can know in that domain with the mind, actually generates what you can hear in music in terms of what is consonant, harmonic, and then what is not, what is dissonant, right?
Mm-hmm.
And back at this point with the smallest parts, right, Kepler's method of investigating the domain of music does not start from some smallest interval, which then he builds up an entire system of harmonic intervals and scales and modes and whatnot. But he actually begins with an entire bounded structure of a string. It says we begin with what we would call harmonic. We begin with the entire string, divided up into harmonic parts, and from there you actually develop small parts. And he actually gives a very good metaphor on this. He says you don't first have some small piece of flesh and then, you know, put a bunch of pieces of flesh together, and then you get a man, right? He says, well, first you have a man, and then you have his parts, right? Not the other way around. So he's getting at this more of an idea of how is the universe organized, and how does the human mind work? Well, I mean, to get more at that point, Kepler asked the question, well, what makes this possible? What makes it possible for the human mind to investigate the universe from a standpoint of a unity as opposed to a standpoint of some smallest particle, which then you build up to a larger part? And this is where he actually goes back to the method of the Greeks, and in particular, very explicitly, the method of Plato as outlined in his Meno dialogue, which people commonly understand of as the doctrine of recollection, where he demonstrates the method of learning our knowledge through the self-taught slave, right? People are somewhat familiar with this. And he actually says that this has to be a necessary philosophy in order for the mind to even know anything. Otherwise, what you have is Aristotle's doctrine, which is the tabula rasa, the blank slate, which actually means you can't know anything, but you merely classify things which are in the physical universe, which what we would know of as matter, or objects, or particles, and whatnot. And you actually deny the idea that a governing principle, or an idea, or a unity does exist. Kepler makes the point that for the human mind to grasp these unities, that the soul, or what is the origin of the human being, already has to have everything written upon it. That, in other words, it has to have knowledge of all things which are already in the universe, simply because the soul of the human being is a product of the physical universe, which it was created by. So there's no separation between the way you're investigating something and what you're investigating. And this is where real creativity comes in, because you have to understand that you're not investigating knowledge of the sense domain, what you're seeing, hearing, and so on and so forth, right? But you're merely looking at the sensible domain to understand, well, what is the principle which is governing what I'm seeing, hearing, and so on and so forth? In other words, what is governing the organization of the smallest parts, which is something that does not exist in matter, but is what Lyndon LaRouche calls a universal physical principle. It's what Kepler would call harmonics, right? So then you have this top-down conception, right? So this is where you get the idea of sight and sound as an investigation of the universe, because now you're saying, okay, I am perceiving with my senses really five different, seemingly different universes. I have the domain of my sight, I have the domain of my hearing, the aural domain, and I have, you know, touch, I have taste, and I have smell, you know, and all these other senses, right? But you have to conceptualize in your mind, or with your what Kepler calls the common sense, that you're actually looking at one universe, which you're perceiving in five different ways. So the mind actually has to come into play and actually bridge the two most important senses, which is sight and sound. And then you begin to get at what is the reality, the true reality, which is occurring in the sensible domain, which is not in the sensible domain. It is in the domain of universal physical principles. Now, this brings it back to the issue of what music really is. And this is really good, because what happened over the recent period, we had some work with the famous Italian vocalist up in Boston, Antonella Bonaudi. And she was able to do something with our vocalist and our movement that had never been done before. And it's still in a fresh phase. Still, you know, we got a little bit of it. We haven't mastered this, but from what I can understand, and I think this is why Mr. LaRouche is bringing this up as of late, is because what's the embodiment of a musical idea in an individual cannot be conceptualized by getting every single note right, or memorizing every word, or memorizing every note and just singing the note for note perfectly. But the actual embodiment of the idea of what the composer intended in the voice, which means you have to have a free voice, which is a lot of hard work. You know, it means that you have to really understand the intention of the composer. You have to understand that you're also in a dialogue with other human beings, other individuals in the universe. It's a social process, right? And you're applying music, so music is, like Kepler says, harmony expressed through the mind of man, which is really how do you communicate ideas and so on, right? So what you're actually doing by embodying a true idea, someone, you know, listening to a piece of music may not hear every note, may not understand everything that you said, right? But nonetheless, because they're human, because they're cognitive, what gets communicated is really an influence upon them. It's not in some fact or some piece of information that they heard, but it was the true embodiment of a musical idea within another human being that then influences the audience in a certain way that maybe they're not even aware of. And to sort of wrap the thing up, we could talk a lot more about it, but you're beginning to see the issue of creativity in music, in politics. And how do you organize? How do you organize individuals? How do you organize society? It's not something which is done by, you know, having a laundry list of things to do and going out and handing out the laundry list and saying, well, this is what you got to do. There's a lot of people who don't understand what's going on. There's a lot of people who are enraged, like you were bringing up, Marcia, about the bailout and whatnot. And it seems that the way you get people to move is not by, you know, brainwashing them with a bunch of facts, but by getting them to grasp an idea. And the communication of an idea is what's crucial for political organizing. And that's how you influence society. That's how you organize people. Like I said, this is all still very rudimentary and very brand new, in a sense, in terms of the work that we're doing. But I think what Sky is saying with the developments that went on through Riemann, onto Köhler and these various people up to this type of scientific work, this is the most essential aspect of it. And this is what Kepler was getting at. This is the subjective, artistic nature of science, which cannot be dismissed. I think that's very important. And I think that's the most important thing we could be focusing on in terms of all the work that we're doing.
Right. And apropos of what you just said, I don't know, Chris, if you have more to say, but of course, I understand part of this ongoing project has been Jesu Meine Freude, the Bach motet, and Bach's genius tempering of an entire system. I mean, his work on the tempered scale. Are you rethinking anything there, or it just in line with everything you've been saying?
It's in line, but I think that'll come. But I think the more important thing is, like, if you want to, I mean, that is important. I'm not denying that, but I kind of wanted to let Sky take over and answer the question that you had proposed earlier with this idea of what more or less what Kepler was getting at.
Well, I'll say this might actually go to both questions.
Yeah.
I mean, the one thing I would suggest, and along as an example, I mean, anybody, you know, who's listening to this, who feels that they, who, if the idea that a living organism is composed of these non-living parts, you've got a living organism that's composed of atoms, and ultimately, if you looked at the atoms, they'd be exactly the same as any other atom, and that doesn't seem strange to you, if that seems normal, then for people listening, you can recognize that you've been swindled.
We have a test.
Yeah, well, and exactly the way to test this thing now, the way to, if you want to figure out how to get a chance to pull yourself outside of yourself and look at that, I think the best way to do it, I mean, you got to do the entire book, but taking a look at book 3 of Kepler's Harmonies as an example, and looking at the way he derives the musical scale. Because it's significant. Most people, when you think about musical composition today, yeah, you think that a musical composition is composed of notes. Like, that's what you're putting on the bar. That's what you're setting up. You're putting these notes, these sort of melodic lines together, and you're building up a musical composition. But now look at how you generated your so-called building blocks. The way these notes are, the effort it takes to build a single whole step or a half step, or in Kepler's case, he's got several species of half step, two species of whole step. If you look at the way this thing is organized, before you have a single note, before you've got a single one of these individual whole steps, half steps, you start off with the harmonic intervals. You start off with harmonic relationship. Harmony exists first as a whole, the large, the gestalt is what exists first. And then from that idea, you generate the component parts. It's the intersection of that idea that lets you generate the component parts. And that origin of these parts explains the peculiar paradox that Kurler discusses in musical composition, which LaRouche has brought up repeatedly, which is that the same note, the same interval, even the same phrase, musical phrase, in an entirely different context is really an entirely different thing. Now, there's nothing really paradoxical about that if you recognize that these things that you are trying to conceptualize as independent entities aren't. They don't have an existence outside of the context in which they exist. This is analogous situs, both in Leibniz's sense and in Riemann's sense. And that concept, I mean, if you want another example of it, it's the same thing as saying, you know, is a line composed of points, or is a point the intersection of two lines? Even though everywhere you check on that line, you can find a point, you can't say now that a line is composed of a point. You can't even really say that if two straight lines cross one another at a point, and then a curved line crosses at that same point, you can't say that point is the same in both cases. Because we know from Leibniz's calculus, if you look at the infinitesimal at that moment, the infinitesimal is different depending on what intersection, you know, how that intersection is made, what qualitative change are you looking at there. So the point has got no character in and of itself outside of the macroscopic organization that created it, the gestalt that created it, the whole idea. And it's the ideas in the large as self-sufficient entities that generate the phenomena in the small. If you recognize that, if you have a very clear sense of that from that pedagogical example, from looking at what Kepler does in Book 3 of the Harmonies, then you can back up and look at the absurdity involved in the assumption that an atom contained in a living process could be exactly the same thing as an atom contained in a non-living process. That you've got supposedly, you know, all these homogeneous entities. You've got all these protons, electrons, and their component particles that are essentially non-differentiated from one another that build up the great variety that you see in the large, you recognize that that's as much of an absurdity as saying that you've got a straight line composed of points, or that musical composition is composed of notes, or even more familiar, you know, the idea that a poem is composed of words. That it's an idea that exists prior and has an independent existence that governs, you know, its so-called component parts. And I think that's important. Like, those are some, the Kepler's harmonies in that sense is one of the most important pedagogical examples that could exist to give yourself a real kind of intuitive sense of this. But then also being involved in trying to express these ideas as wholes, which is what LaRouche has been stressing, the question of having to convey a thoroughly composed idea, in particular music, he's been stressing, first with the choral work, with the work that we've been doing on and is ongoing with the Jesu Minor Freude, some of these other choral pieces, to make it clear that musical expression, you know, is not, you know, it's not performance, it's not look at me. It's collaborative work on communicating a coherent idea to another human mind. And that was sort of the, you know, an important phase in us elaborating some of these ideas as choral ideas.
Right.
And now that we have a sense of that, that you can know what an idea is, and you know what it means to try and communicate this thing, we've got a chance to pose to ourselves the more difficult task of posing these things in different types of solo work. You know, can you as an individual embody a conception? And recognize that conception as a whole, not sit back and reel out the parts, right? Not crank out note after note, not crank out word after word, not give people information, but can you give a concept to a population that they can now take and use that to generate all the component parts of that concept?
Yes. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, that's where we stand, because that question, being able to accomplish that in the arts, being able to translate that into the work in science, That's the question of where we stand right now politically, of being able to help the American population, but then the world, to help the U.S. population at this moment of crisis, take a step back from all the you know, the facts, the all the conflicts that seem to be in their immediate environment, because they have immediate problems. You know, people really are losing their homes, people really are losing their jobs, people are finding it harder to exist. In society, the population is going mad. All these things are true. And all these things are these sort of independent sort of, you know, particles that are floating around people. But can you get them to step back and take a look, get a real clear look at the whole arc of human history, to look at where we stand right now, and to see how what they're looking at is a localized expression of a process in the large, of a gestalt, of a whole idea. And for us, that's our task. That's our task of artistic communication as a political movement. And that's going to require some very intensive work in intensifying the work that we're doing in the music and the science and elsewhere.
Chris, you wanted to add to that or no?
No, that's good. I was going to give one very good example of this for Kepler, because one thing that Kepler brings up, because as a metaphysical point, because I mean that's what Sky is getting at, is this idea of it's really dealing with what is the nature of man, right? You're dealing with a metaphysical point. What makes the mind of man? What gives it the possibility to do what we've just discussed? You know, very briefly, but I mean it's a much more broad discussion. But you know, in this short hour, Kepler does say things about human beings in such a way that that the mind of man already understands the concepts that, you know, that are being discussed. And one example he gives is that, you know, he gives the example of peasants and barbarians and uneducated boys, and he says that, you know, look, you can present harmonics and musical harmonics to uneducated people, and they'll recognize that they're harmonics, even though they've had no prior education of what this is. And it's merely because they may not know intellectually what what you're doing or what this principle is, right? But they already understand it in some way or another. And it's kind of like that's kind of how the musical principle works, is that you may not intellectually understand everything like Beethoven was doing or Bach or Mozart was doing, right? But that work, if performed properly, that's another emphasis, has a certain influence upon you, which, you know, this is what really brings out this this necessary part of the human soul. So I think that in the political organizing and various things like that, to get people to conceptualize these type of things, the work on music has to do explicitly with how do you communicate to other human beings in such a way that they can understand, not just like you're bombarding them with things, but how do they understand what you're trying to communicate about, you know, history and society and you know, politics in general. How do you get people to conceptualize and grasp these ideas? Because, you know, sometimes you can, you know, you find yourself without an idea, and you end up confusing people more than you end up organizing them, you know? So, I mean, there's a lot more to this, but I think this there's a lot of fundamental work being done here now, which is necessary for this moment in history. Because really what you're talking about is introducing real creativity again into society, and I think that's something which our enemies fear a lot. So, anyway.
Right. Well, we only have a couple more minutes, but one thing, back to what both of you and Sky mentioned explicitly about deliberate or about upgrade, upshifts at certain times in history, the intervention of ideas that I think historically the American system, not just the founding of the United States, but the American system development was coherent with all you're saying about real political and economic creativity, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think LaRouche, in his paper where he's addressing real creativity, the one I said is out today, and I recommend everyone look on, I want to again say, larouchepack.com, LaRouchePac.com, and also look for the pamphlet of LaRouche's solution, What Can Be Done at this time in history on the economy, that he gave at his webcast in Washington, D.C. recently. This is available, and it's also in print form, and that also requires people's resources to contribute, to donate. But in the latest paper LaRouche wrote, he's talking about succeeding in what you just said, Chris, that we reintroduce real creativity and being able to have discovery of universal physical principles resume after the Dark Age allows man to willfully have an to literally create an ecology improving effect, he said. You know, you create your own natural resources, you create your own ecology. So in conclusion, I guess, do you have anything to say about that, or I guess that's the point.
I think people should have some fun. It's funny, people are so nervous right now, and you're starting to, it's people are being shaken up, and they're realizing that the idea that they had accepted over the last few decades, that there's, you know, all you're looking, you just need to find your niche. You've just got to find your comfortable state, the things you want around you in life, and just try to keep it there, right? You got to find the right job, just get the right family, just once you live in the right climate, you know, once everything is just right, then you just got to stay there. And what's driving the population mad right now is the recognition that that's impossible. But what would let them have a little bit of fun is to realize that that's never been possible, and it's contrary to the nature of human civilization, right? You know, rabbits or other creatures like that, they find little stable states and just sort of stay there until calamity collapses their population, and they build up, and they don't do much different over the course of millennia.
Robert Burns wrote a poem about a mouse that had a nest in the field that was plowed up, yes.
Exactly, yeah, right? And this is what's happening to the population, right? They're realizing they're not mice, you know. They had themselves nuzzled into the hole, and now the hole is plowed up, and, you know, they're in a panic, and they're enraged. They're angry about the wrong thing. What they need to do is step back and say, well, yes, things are problematic, but you know, I don't know what the standards are in the show, but I guess I can be bleak, but
yes,
they need to realize that things are much more profoundly fucked up than they thought.
Okay.
It's not a question of the things that they think are their immediate problems are not their immediate problems. The profound disaster that they've sort of partaken in over the last few decades is that humanity has gotten off track. We don't have a stable state. There's no stable point up to which humanity evolves and then sort of sits there. That nature of creative, that characteristic of creative discovery, that ability to pull back, look at your set systems of beliefs and traditions as a whole, and to figure out where are these inadequate, and to push for a negentropic, an anti-entropic development and advance of those characteristics, where we, you know, where we're capable of living. Should we be moving off the Earth? Yes, we should, to expand out, explore in person the rest of our solar system, explore the universe outside of our solar system. All of that stuff, all of these things are considerations and are sort of inevitable steps in the evolution of the human species. We have to be in a position to continually shake ourselves up as a species. What that means is we have to be in a position to continually shake ourselves up as individual human beings and challenge what up until now have been our accepted comfort zones, ways of life, ways of living.
Traditions.
Our traditions. Yeah, exactly. And if we can do that, we've got a chance of survival. If we don't do that, we're just going to be just like the mouse being plowed up in the field. He has some burns to tone. You know, we'll be as, you know, we'll be do what people are manifesting right now around the financial crisis. We're going to be like a bunch of panicked deer who get upset because, you know, some car drove through their field or something.
Right. Well, that's a positive note, and the time has run out. So I have to thank you, Sky Shields, Chris Landry, mm-hmm. and this is October 11th, 2008, The LaRouche Show. Please listen October 18th, where every Saturday from 3 to 4 on the EIR News Service website, which is www.larouchepub.com, LaRouchePub.com. This is Marcia Mary Baker, and I thank you all very much.
All right, thank you, Marcia. Have fun having fun.
I will, and you all. Thank you.
Bye-bye.